I'm George Liston, CA. Here are the words the world remembers. England expects every man will do his duty. They were signaled from Admiral Horatio Nelson's flagship Victory to the English ships that confronted a combined French-Spanish fleet off Trafalgar on the 21st of October, 1805. The battle that raged that day holds a singular place in the history and imagination of Britain to this day. It was an epical event, like the later Gettysburg would be for Americans, or the even later Stalingrad for Russians. Besides preserving England's masteries of the seas, it also defined English heroism and the idealized character that would henceforth illuminate the nation. The men of Lord Nelson's fleet did their duty that day, as did he. And by sunset, Horatio Nelson had departed this world for the pantheon where a nation's heroes live forever. My guest is Adam Nicholson, author of Seize the Fire, Heroism, Duty, and the Battle of Trafalgar. Adam, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
Let me hold up this handsome volume so we can both look at it and viewers as well. And let me start by saying, Adam, that the very title, Seize the Fire, put me in mind of O for a Muse of Fire, which of course opens Henry V, and I thought that was kind of appropriate because both Henry V and Horatio Nelson on the 21st October 1805 had to call on the same qualities of violence in the service of country. And I'd like you to speak to that, because your very first sentence speaks to a tradition of violence in Britain. It wakes the reader up. I didn't know much about that tradition of violence.
Yes, I mean, there is a sort of expectation among the English, and perhaps one that they propel to the rest of the world, that the English are a sweet, cricket-playing, warm beer-loving, cake-eating country. And it's obvious enough, I think, you know, a second thought would tell you that you don't create a world empire on the basis of those qualities. And there is a strong thread in the whole of English history of really extreme violence, ruthlessness, and a kind of directed refusal to take hostages, really, to go for it, in other
right.
words. And, I mean, for example, in the English Civil War, a higher proportion of the English nation died than the French did in the French Revolution.
That's right, that's brought out in the book.
Even in the 18th century, you know, when the English government suppressed the Highlanders after Bonnie Prince Charlie's rebellion in Scotland, it was as brutal a suppression as any in European history and scandalized the rest
right.
of Europe. And it's undoubtedly true that that sort of drive for the total answer, which ruthlessness involves, really, was in play at Trafalgar and mobilized by Nelson.
Called into play yeah. by Nelson, Nelson's eloquence, his example, his bravery, and so much else besides. There's a phrase in the book that occurs explaining this violence as, quote, kind of righteousness in action. I mean, this sense that this was what one had to do. The amazing thing that the book also brings out to me, Adam, was that how far into the public this had permeated. That is to say, the unlettered men aboard the Victory and all the other ships shared this. The unenfranchised, if we may speak, of England aboard those ships had this feeling he could call on.
Yes, I mean, I think that sort of one vehicle by which this feeling emerges is the deep tradition of apocalyptic violence mm-hmm. leading to a millennium of peace and happiness. Obviously, that is a common inheritance of the whole of Christendom, really.
Well, I leap on that simply because, again, this book, and you depict it as, quote, the mental landscape, if you will, behind this horrific battle that's going on. But you're quite right, and I'd speak a moment on this. The roots of this feeling, the roots of the passion, are in many ways classic. I mean, the Hebraic, Greek, Roman, is that so?
Yes, I mean, I think that it's very easy in a sort of rather lazy way to think of European civilization as a matter of, elegance mm-hmm. and civility and calm. But deep, even in sort of the Homeric poems, for example, mm-hmm. and certainly in the whole tradition, as you say, from the Old Testament and of the Revelations, there is this idea that life itself ultimately is about terrible violence, mm. and that without terrible violence, you can't reach the real, even, that the ultimate truth and the ultimate sort of resolution of things only lies the other side right. of terrible violence.
Right.
I mean, it's certainly true of Achilles. It's clearly true of the visions in Revelation.
That's right.
And this this apocalypse millennium duo surfaces regularly in English history. It was mm-hmm. certainly there in the 17th century, the time of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It was certainly there in the 1830s when the movement mm-hmm. to enfranchise the people. And it is certainly here at this moment, around 1790s, 1805.
It's interesting. There's so much to talk to you about. Let me see if I can do it in some kind of organized fashion. It's interesting you skipped the 18th century in that little rundown, because that's the century of politeness, as you describe it. It's almost kind of counterintuitive to the rest. And it seems to me that Nelson's period, what he reintroduces, or what everything tends to reintroduce at that point, is a response to that politeness, which is this aggressiveness that you call to mind.
That is really what this book is about. It's about that deep shift from the 18th century view of the ideal person.
Yeah,
refined. Sort of people we're being now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we could get rough.
But to uh-huh. the sort of thing that happens in battle. And it's uh-huh. that shift from sort of calm, easy, generous, gentle mm-hmm. as the idea behind civilization to the authentic, mm-hmm. the absolutely unadorned, mm-hmm. the rough, because in roughness you find truth. And so, the killing.
This is what's marvelous here, because it is all of those things you've just said, and it's also the active expression, if you will, of a terrific class change that we see. Lord Nelson himself, and let's introduce him at this moment, and his officers, in particular, represent now a middle class on the make, if I may use that phrase. Mm. Let's turn to Nelson first. I mean, what kind of man is he, Adam? I mean, he's got the full range of qualities, and he's what I think Henri Bergson would have called an ardent nature.
He is ardent. He burns. Like Achilles, he burns.
Right.
But, I mean, I think that what you just said is right, that it's very easy, and people have always really looked at Nelson as if he's an aberrational figure, as if he's just sort of great spike standing up out of history. Mm-hmm. It is possible, and in some ways this book is about this, to see him as entirely typical of his moment. Mm-hmm. And the moment is that shift from what you could call an aristocratic, stable view of society and self, that you are what you were born to be, that calm politeness is your mm-hmm. Is your mode, to a more entrepreneurial, bourgeois, commercial,
right.
urban form of the self,
right.
which means you have to struggle to be what you are.
Yeah. Once again, I'm getting carried away, but it strikes me that one of the great expressions of that is on that day at Trafalgar, and of course, as a matter of tradition at that point, these naval officers, middle-class men, Jane Austen even would point this out, moving up, would compete for prizes in the sense. I mean, you capture a ship, you get a lot of money if you do that.
A lot of money,
and you can actually propel yourself up the ladder of life with
that's right. I mean, the captains at Trafalgar got £10,000.
Which today is?
Well, you could multiply by 150 easily. Mm. So $1.5 million, $2.5 million. You know, it really does set you up. You get a nice house for that.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And I think that all these things, in a way, do dovetail with each other. There is a sense that in the millenarian, in the apocalyptic violence, is your destiny.
Right.
There is a kind of view of man as the sort of entrepreneurial market figure. Mm-hmm. And battle is the ultimate market. It's the ultimate place where you can get that enormous mm-hmm. sudden prize, which then establishes you as a dominant figure in society.
How are the arts poetry in particular, I suppose, prose indeed, reinforcing what we're talking about. And I'm speaking here because I think the title comes from a Blake poem, does it not?
It does. It does come from a Blake poem. I mean, you couldn't really think of two figures sort of more different than Nelson and Blake. Mm. Nelson very much in the establishment, in some ways loved by the establishment, in very kind of coarse, conservative figure in many ways.
Right.
And Blake, utterly marginalised, poor, despised, virtually unheard of at the time. But you look at what Blake writes about this need for immediacy, spontaneity, the sort of truth in the naked, mm-hmm. in a complete dispensing with the fripperies and conventions of 18th century conventional life. Mm-hmm. And you can see in what Blake writes about essentially human nature exactly Nelson's attitude to war and men.
Right.
That war must be direct, uncompromising, not bothering with the fripperies, mm-hmm. Spontaneous and impassioned.
There's a raw passion to Nelson's action, to Blake's poetry. But, it's amazing when you think of this, because it goes counter to the stereotypical notion of what Englishness is, isn't it?
It does, and I think in some ways the 19th century remembered this, mm-hmm. and the later 19th century remembered this about the beauty of the hero and so on.
Right.
But in some ways it forgot it. It's this sort of bubbling romantic, with a capital R, rage and glory.
Right.
Develops a kind of Victorian carapace, sort of thick thing, both in social form, you know, in the sort of need to behave with decorum. They're mm-hmm. deeply undecorous, these men.
That's,
you know,
right, that's
they
right.
don't know anything about decorum mm-hmm. at all in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy also, after Nelson, started to suppress these ardent middle-class figures, and mm-hmm. it became an aristocratic thing. You had to be a grandee to become a naval officer in Victorian England.
You know, this whole business of speaking to these, dare we say, atavistic passions, and the whole thing does remind you of a lot of the crowd around Henry V, you know, they're rough-hewn, we will do it for God, Harry, and St. George, and all of that. But it's significant, isn't it, Adam, that when the signal is sent throughout the fleet, it doesn't signal Britain, it signals England. I mean, and the sailors come from everywhere, the Bahamas as well as the colonies, really.
They do. I mean, it's a globally manned fleet. I mean, there are a lot of Americans fighting on the British side. There are some French fighting on the British side, many from India. There's an Australian officer there and so on. But the signal every man expects, sorry, England expects that every man will do his duty. Well, it is England because England has a resonance which Britain does not. And the resonance it has is of a place of purity, of almost sort of medieval chivalric honesty. And Britain is this striving, controlling, rather degraded place.
Mm.
But England...
That's the ideal.
Is the England of Henry V.
Right, right.
And undoubtedly, Nelson knew that great speech that you quoted from Henry V, and refers to it constantly, and it is a speech about honour, classlessness, mm-hmm. Victory, and the sort of radiant self.
Well said. Let's come to the battle itself.
Mm.
This battle is fought by what you correctly describe as beautiful machines. Really, and one of the great, for those who sail, one of the great wealths of this book, treasure of the book, is the fact it describes so aptly in ways I, quite frankly, have never encountered before. What makes these ships up? What makes them move? What makes them go? And they are beautiful machines in the way that they're put together. They're also beautiful machines in the way they're run, in what I would call, and this book catalogs a series of values that are depicted by the officers and men. There's the symmetry of discipline, but also of values such as love and honor that works through these beautiful machines.
Yes, they, you know, it was a Newtonian world that they were living in, that Newton was in the relatively recent past. And the idea of something organizing many little parts into a coherent and smoothly running whole is undoubtedly one of the ideals of the fleet and of 18th century man.
Right.
You need this. They're very tender, these huge ships. They are full of vulnerabilities and delicacies, and they are breaking the whole time. Mm-hmm. And you need to mend and repair these things. They're in constant transformation.
You use that word tender about the ships. There's also a tenderness about the men. You know, even within all this rough-hewnness, and you're quite right to cite that, I was struck by caring.
Yes. I mean, I've been really hammered in the British press by saying that the Navy at the time was a love structure. But it's undoubtedly true that they loved each other, that not sexily, mm-hmm. but although there certainly was sex between men, but not, I don't mean that primarily. It was more that they were heirs to the great revolution in sensibility that had happened in the 18th century.
Right.
And it was a mark of being a gentleman, mm-hmm. that you felt deep affection for the people around you. In a way, it was what qualified you to be on the quarterdeck. It's what qualified you to be in command, that you had those honourable, amiable qualities, as they called mm-hmm. them. But there is something very interesting about this, and there are, as you say, parallels between men and machines, that in some ways the whole essence of it is care, tenderness. You make sure that your men have lemons to prevent them getting scurvy.
18,000 pounds.
18,000 lemons mm-hmm, per ship mm-hmm. and so on. Nelson really looks after the men, that make sure that they can send letters and get letters back and so on. And it is a world of care.
Yeah.
But it's a world that is cared for, because only if it is deeply cared for will it be a very good killing machine.
When the time comes.
Mm-hmm. And you can see at Trafalgar this intense attention to detail, of meticulous mm-hmm. keeping it whole, flick over in an instant to absolutely untrammeled killing intensity.
And let me pick up on that. The killing intensity and the carnage. I read it, this is a 21st century reader, and we think we know it all about what these machines of war can do. I was stunned. I was stunned by the carnage, by what weapons we think of as antiquated and almost toy-like were not. Yeah. Even a concussion from a three-ton cannon can take your head off. I mean, it's that kind of thing.
It's a world of extreme violence, and it is made more violent by the way in which Nelson does it. Mm. That 18th century naval war had been often a rather gentlemanly affair, mm-hmm. that you would bring your two fleets into sort of parallel line and have a few shots across the gap between right. you. A little light cannonading is one description of 18th century battle. Mm. Nelson does exactly the opposite. He drives his fleet into the middle of
of
the enemy.
That's right.
At right angles, and explodes it from inside.
As I read that, I said, my God, he's provoking a melee. He wants to make the thing disorganized. It'll be every ship for itself, in a sense, within the general rule of doing as much damage as you can.
It's chaos as a tool of battle. It's anarchy.
Contrasted with, on the other side, now the largest ship of the line there is the Santissima Trinidad. It's a four-decker. It's got 98 guns, as I recall. It's Spanish.
More even. More 120.
120 guns. Mm. But it and the entire combined French-Spanish fleet fail, but largely because there's the antithesis of what we've been talking about. It's kind of an aristocracy at sea.
Certainly that's true of the Spanish, that you've to be an officer in the Spanish Royal Navy, you had to be an aristocrat. There is no Spanish middle class at the time, or tiny. So you have on board these ships an extremely tightly defined aristocratic clique in charge, and a huge body of unlettered peasants below them. Incredibly, for the Spaniards, the people in charge, the commanders, did not know how to sail the ships.
Right.
They thought their job was to fight rather nobly when they got into battle. Some junior officer could be relegated to the task of actually steering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as an organism, that does not hang together. It is not mm-hmm. a coherent thing. The British To qualify as a British officer, you have to have been 6 years at sea, you have to know your knots, mm-hmm. you have to be able to navigate a ship and so on. Mm-hmm. They're like two different versions of society coming into conflict.
That's exactly what rings through this book. Mm. I mean, it's not a simplification to say that, because there is this kind of effete, class-ridden Spanish approach to this, and then these strivers we're talking about, these middle class, we've got to make this thing work. On the other side, let us come now to the death and transfiguration of Horatio Nelson. Mm. This is a moment of almost biblical intensity, depicted in many paintings. Some capture it, others don't. But it's, I think, fair to say, a noble death, and perhaps even in a sense a beautiful death. But what is its meaning? I mean, what happens other than, I think it's from 130 to that he's. But he's mortally wounded.
That's right. And then
so what
he
do those
dies.
Hours mean?
He dies 3 hours later. Mm-hmm. And almost uniquely, certainly for the time, every single thing that happens to him in those 3 hours was recorded. Every word he said mm-hmm. was written down. Every action he made was written down by the surgeon on Victory. And so, at one level anyway, it is an extraordinary death because very few deaths are that closely known. You hear Nelson going through all the different frames of mind that the dying go through. Mm-hmm. He half loses consciousness. He dreams of the past. He becomes extremely anxious. He becomes very, very fond and sentimental about those he loves at home and those around him. He worries that his life has been a waste. He asserts pride in what he's done. And the people know, who've been with those who are dying, that that is exactly what happens, that you have this kind of flickering consciousness moving through every conceivable sphere of their life. Mm-hmm. And this record of Nelson's dying is an extraordinarily moving thing, simply at that human level. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it also becomes Nelson. That account of him by the surgeon William Beatty was printed the following year and a huge instant bestseller in London. Mm. And the Nelson that Victorian England knew was this deeply human figure.
Right.
And I think transfiguration is a very interesting word you should use about that, because in some ways, of course, he is moving into a Christ-like condition, or you know, the great saint, the dying saint, or the dying Messiah. But he's also at the same time moving down off any possible social plinth to a level of absolutely common humanity. Mm. And I think that that sort of bifurcation of the idea of Nelson is what became the 19th century inherited idea of what the hero was.
That's marvelous, he said. What was the fate then of Emma Hamilton and Horatia, his daughter, about whom he cared immensely? I mean, there's great eloquence and passion.
He did.
Letter to her.
He loved Emma Hamilton and their daughter more intensely than anything else on earth. And on the morning of Trafalgar, before they engaged, he wrote a codicil to his will, leaving her, his mistress, and their daughter to the British state. Mm. An unheard-of thing to do, and mad, really. Mm. I mean, it was inconceivable that the British state would have done anything except what it did do, which was neglect them entirely. And Emma Hamilton fell into poverty. She sold to a hack publisher her letters from Nelson. Mm. She took to the drink, got into terrible debt, went to live in Calais and died in utter poverty there.
Oh, dear. Horatia?
Horatia was taken up by Nelson's relations and married a vicar and became a vicar's wife in Kent and died, I think, in the 1880s. There's a photograph of her looking exactly like Nelson.
God. Where is he buried?
Nelson was put in a huge barrel.
Mm-hmm. With spirits.
With spirits.
To preserve him.
To preserve his
marine
body.
Marine standing.
His body, with a marine standing, guarding him. and was brought back to England in the barrel, and then a huge state funeral with his body being carried on a barge up the River Thames to St. Paul's Cathedral. And the whole of the British establishment was there, not Emma Hamilton, not even his wife, not even Lady Nelson. They were all excluded. 40 men, and it was immensely pompous and very un-Nelsonian, sort of proto-Victorian thing, except for one moment when 40 of the crew of Victory, his flagship, were there as the sort of guard, the honour guard of his coffin. And over his coffin was draped the flag from the Victory. And completely unprompted, at the central moment in this, the 40 men from Victory rushed forward and tore the flag into pieces and put each piece in their pocket as a souvenir of the man they loved.
Human passion speaking at the end.
Absolutely.
That's marvelous. Well, as we come to the end of our conversation, Adam, I want to ask you a question that may be obvious. You know, one of the things is Trafalgar has a sound of fate, doesn't it? I mean, there's certain places that are almost made for historic battles just by the sound of their name. And I learned from the book it means the point of the cove, doesn't it, in Arabic?
Actually. The cave, the point of the cave, cave. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Just in a sentence, at the end now, 200, exactly 200 years on, is he more than just an 18-foot tall statue in Trafalgar Square? What remains?
I think that for the English, and perhaps you know, for anyone, Nelson remains the key example, I think, of a man who can lead by a magical ability to make people love him.
Beautifully said, sir. Thank you so much, Adam Nicholson.
Thank you.
Thank you for the book.
Great pleasure.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Adam Nicholson. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.